Ready to proceed?
Morning, Your Honor. Kevin Howard here for the appellant, Kevin McDonald. May it please the court, this is the second argument in this particular matter. First, the court's recollection, argued before a three-judge panel, I think it was probably 4 or 5 months ago. It's a one-issue case. It involves a car stopped by a member of the governor's task force here in Kent County. They're a street-level drug interdiction branch of the state police. They mix probation officers with their police officers in that role. But this involved a single police officer who, at approximately 12:15 at night, 12:15 a.m., entered a parking lot of a convenience store. And as he traveled through the parking lot, he noticed parked facing the store, lawfully parked, a vehicle with two occupants and another individual standing nearby. The record's unclear whether or not there was even any interaction between these people, but that was his initial observation. In response to that, his testimony was that he entered the tag number into his police computer and waited to see what happened. He indicated that the tag came back as fictitious. The car, at about that same time, backed out and began to exit the parking lot. As it got to the road edge, it made a right-hand turn without activating a turn signal, and the police officer testified that he believed that that was a violation of the motor vehicle code. But just prior to that, and as the car drove by his vehicle, he claims that he double-checked the numbers that he had entered into his police computer against the tag that was driving by him and determined that he had accurately entered those numbers. He immediately activated his emergency equipment as the car exited the parking lot and pulled it over. From the appellant's perspective, there are several problems with those actions. First, the motor vehicle code in Delaware doesn't apply to parking lots, especially not the obligation to activate a turn signal within 300 feet of your intention to move left or right. The record in this case is this particular parking lot wasn't even 300 feet long. So if you accepted the police officer's theory, you would never be able to lawfully exit the parking lot. But in any event, the statute...
Howard, it is a fact, is it not, that in the reason given by the police officer for the stop was the failure of the driver to indicate with his turn signal 300 feet before the turn. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
I mean, it was basically the...
It was the primary reason. It was in his affidavit of probable cause as the only reason that he activated his emergency equipment and stopped the vehicle.
All right. But in the later, in his testimony, the officer, in response to questions by the prosecutor, basically set forth other reasons why he was suspicious and stopped the car.
Actually, those questions were by the trial judge, Your Honor.
Excuse me, yes.
The trial judge asked a series of questions, eliciting responses that, yes, this area was known for drug activity, and it was dark, it was at night. He saw somebody talking to two people in a vehicle. He thought they were talking. He wasn't really sure about that.
As amended, it is the fact that other circumstances were testified to that, in effect, buttressed the rationale for the Terry stop.
Only for whatever reason in the mind of the trial judge, because the police officer candidly admitted that none of those circumstances had anything to do with why he stopped the vehicle.
Well, if those other circumstances had materialized in the affidavit of probable cause,
well, we might
had
not
been added to the one reason that did appear in the affidavit, would that, in your view, have been sufficient to constitute probable cause?
On this record, no, Your Honor, because the police officer candidly admitted he didn't witness anything illegal happening. He just saw two people lawfully parked in a car and one individual standing nearby. That in and of itself, even if you were in a high crime area or a high drug area, wouldn't constitute a basis for a reasonable suspicion without more. Now, if, for instance,
you're saying two things here. One is that those other circumstances can't be given credence, even if they were in the affidavit, because the officer didn't consider them as real reasons for suspicion. Is that right?
Yeah, he didn't consider them at all.
Didn't consider them at all.
They didn't factor into his thought process, and frankly...
All right. Secondly, you seem to argue, and I don't know whether this is an addition to this argument or not, that in any event, even if he did consider those additional circumstances, combined with the one that was set forth in the affidavit, would not be legally sufficient.
That's correct, Your Honor. The record in this case, and the trial judge is, for instance, at one point, the trial judge...
But the answer to my question is yes?
Yes. Used the expression unprovoked flight to describe the vehicle with the occupants backing out and leaving the parking lot. Well, I guess that any time we go to the grocery store and we decide to leave, we're all engaging in unprovoked flight, because that's all they did was back up and leave, not in a furtive manner, not in a rapid manner, just backed up and left the parking lot.
There's nothing in the record that supports the suspicion, much less the view that the occupants of the vehicle or the person standing next to the vehicle saw a police car in the parking lot, and that motivated their departure.
That's correct, Your Honor. There's nothing about eye contact.
Help me focus the standard of what we're trying to decide in this case. Are you arguing that it was a pretextual traffic stop for the turn signal that isn't supported by the law because you didn't have to put it on and you could never turn it on 300 feet before the intersection anyway? So that's one question. Is it a pretextual traffic stop? Or is it a Terry stop where you're contending there's no reasonable articulable suspicion? Because as I understand it, once the police officer started interacting with the car, and there was some contraband in plain view.
Your Honor, the contraband was located in the passenger's underwear. He gave a fictitious name when he was asked. In fact, the police officer went to the passenger side of the car at the time of the stop. He recognized the occupant, asked for a name, and it was a fictitious name. So,
isn't there some testimony in the record about seeing blunts in plain view that are sometimes used for drug activity?
I don't recall that, Your Honor. But the stop or the seizure took place immediately upon the car exiting the parking lot when the police officer activated his emergency equipment because he believed he had witnessed a traffic violation.
Well, let's go back then to my question. Is this a Terry stop or a pretextual traffic stop?
I didn't raise the issue of a pretextual stop in this particular case. Because he did cite him, although I think it's certainly something that could be argued under the circumstances, but there was not one but two circumstances that I don't for one second the police officer legitimately believed were reasons to stop the car. He just wanted to stop the car because he's a street-level drug interdiction officer, and that's his job, stop and search anything he can get his hands on in that area of Kent County. But so I didn't raise that issue.
So we're going to decide it strictly as a Terry stop.
That's from my perspective, the way the court should analyze it. And no matter how you look at this, there wasn't a motor vehicle violation in turning out of the parking lot. It just wasn't. The motor vehicle code doesn't apply to parking lots. And as the Chief Justice pointed,
could I interrupt for a second? What about the business about the tag?
I was just going to get that.
Because I understand clearly that it was the officer's mistake and that, in fact, the tag was valid. However, for purposes of having a reasonable articulable suspicion, if we take at face value the officer's claim that he not only put the number in once, he put it in twice, and made the same mistake. Maybe he's dyslexic, but whatever. Made the same mistake twice, but at the time that he made the stop, he did believe, based upon having done that not once but twice, that the tag was invalid.
Well, once again, he said in his affidavit of probable cause that it was the turn signal. But as the Chief Justice pointed out last time we were here, it's not against the law to have an unregistered motor vehicle in a parking lot. And so at the time that he ran that tag, assuming for a moment, sake of argument.
But it is unlawful to drive it on the streets, isn't it? And when he stopped him, he was already on the street.
The police officer had decided to stop him before he left the parking lot.
Back up a second. You're saying that the timing of your developing of reasonable articulable suspicion is going to control, if I understand you, you're saying, well, when he became concerned that this person was driving a car with an invalid tag, the person was on private property, so he didn't have to have a valid tag. And he would only be able to make the stop if that thought came to him after the car pulled out of the parking lot?
I'm not suggesting that. I didn't suggest that in my brief either. It has to be a reasonable, articulable suspicion. And in my brief, I suggested to the court that you not give police officers, like this particular police officer, a license to manufacture a reasonable suspicion.
Wait a second. So your argument is that if we could get inside the officer's head and if we knew we were really comfortable with the idea that this person was a careful, by-the-book kind of police officer who made an error inputting information but relied upon that erroneous information, that would be all right. But if we were to say it was all right, it would create a problem because then police officers would realize all I have to do is push in the wrong numbers and get an answer that says this guy's driving on an invalid tag, and boom, I'm ready to stop anybody I see.
That is a concern that I expressed in my brief, that we should not lay that scenario. We should not give police officers a mechanism by which they can claim good faith just by entering numbers in a computer that are wrong.
But doesn't that require us to be working from the premise that police officers are going to lie and break the law in order to be able to stop people?
I don't think you have to go that far. I think in this particular case, the police officer, if you decide that this independently this tag issue could create a reasonable and articulable suspicion, you're going to analyze that. You know, you have to decide whether or not if the police officer's mistake is what manufactures the suspicion, whether it's reasonable. And I'm suggesting to you it's not. There's no good faith exception in Delaware to our application of the Fourth Amendment or Article 1, Section 6. And that's where we'd be going. Well, he acted in good faith, so we have to let the stop stand. And I'm suggesting you as a matter of a blanket prospect, if they manufacture the suspicion because they make a mistake, then the court should not find that's reasonable. It is a one-issue case. If there are no more questions at this
one,
point.
Just one. What record are we supposed to be relying on in order to perform our analysis? That is, are we limited to the affidavit of probable cause?
No, there's a transcript from a suppression hearing, and the police officer testified during that suppression hearing.
Okay, well, that gets us back, I guess, to my first question. In that trial transcript, the testimony of the officer who did the Terry stop, in response to questions elicited, as you pointed out by the judge, set forth a number of other circumstances that at least arguably would create reasonable, articulable suspicion.
Judge,
how do you respond to that?
I guess if the scenario were that this police officer enters this parking lot and his radar is up immediately because it's a known drug area and frequent place where he makes arrests and that sort of thing, we might be in a different posture, but that's not what happened.
I'm not following you. Let's make it simple. In the affidavit of probable cause, the officer says, I stopped this car because of circumstance A. and then at the trial testifies that in addition to circumstance A, there were circumstances B, C, D, and E.
Well, he didn't strictly say that. I mean, the trial judge tossed out some of those questions. He answered them, but then he said, but that had nothing to do with why I stopped the vehicle. So in terms of the totality of the circumstances and his analysis at the...
And we're bound by that. That is, that characterization or that statement by the policeman, the officer, is basically a fact that we're bound by.
I believe it is, yes. And moreover, the facts as were developed in the record indicated exactly the opposite, that there wasn't anything about that encounter with these two citizens that was suspicious.
Suppose the officer said, well, there were all of the circumstances B, C, D, and E, were also there. I just didn't put it in my affidavit, but they did enter into the mix.
I might be making a different argument, Your Honor, and that argument would be that those circumstances, although he testified about them, the record doesn't bear them out. There are no facts to support any of that nonsense, excuse my expression, that those conclusions or representations by the police officer.
Mr. Howard, I want to come back to my earlier question. Your initial response made me think I had the wrong case, which is possible that I would get cases confused. But in this case, in the state's brief, it says, on the driver's seat of the vehicle, Haik observed what appeared to be cocaine. In the center console area between the two front seats, he saw what he suspected was marijuana and a Phillies blunt cigar. So the reason that's relevant, at least to my earlier question, is once he makes contact with the people, he sees things that might lead him to take the passenger and the driver into custody. As I understand your argument, he should have never been seeing any of these things in the first place because there was no reasonable, articulable suspicion to stop the car.
That's correct, Your Honor. It starts and stops with the police officer activating his emergency equipment. That is the point of the seizure in this matter.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. May it please the court. This is a case involving a police investigatory stop, and the question is whether or not the police officer, Delaware State Police Corporal David Haik, had reasonable, articulable suspicion to stop a motor vehicle that Mr. Juan Lucas was driving and in which Kevin McDonald was a front seat passenger. The state's position is that the trial judge who conducted a pretrial evidentiary hearing on the defense suppression motion did not abuse his discretion in denying the pretrial evidence suppression motion. The police officer had reasonable articulable suspicion to stop the Honda Accord in this particular instance. What happened here was that the officer is driving northbound, I think he said, on Route 13 north of Felton. There is a Sure Stop convenience store that's open 24 hours along the highway. As the officer is passing by, he sees a vehicle in the parking lot of the Sure Stop, and there is another individual who's standing outside the vehicle. The officer pulls into the parking lot, and as he's going by the car, he looks at the tag number, punches the tag number as he's continuing through the parking lot into his mobile computer inside the patrol car, and that shows that the tag is unregistered, at least according to what he entered. Ultimately, he determines back at the troop after the stop and everything and the individuals are taken into custody that he has apparently transposed a 1 and a 9 two of the last three numbers in the tag. He takes the tag off the car as well after he seizes the car, and he checks it a third time. He also says that the officer's testimony was that as he goes through the parking lot and comes back around, he glances at the tag a second time to verify the number and apparently makes the same mistake a second time.
Mr. Williams.
Yes, Your Honor.
In order to establish a reasonable articulable suspicion, it must be based on specific facts. If this were a warrant, Dorsey teaches us that actual probable cause for the issuance of a search warrant can't be based upon a good faith belief, which is what I believe Corporal Hake had here, but it has to be based on fact. And therefore, the articulable suspicion based on the registration problem is not based on fact. In order for the state to prevail, do we have to overrule Dorsey?
No, I don't think you have to do that.
Is the warrant requirement different from the articulable suspicion requirement when it comes to the Delaware Constitution and the necessity that it be based on fact?
No, I don't think it is. I think it's objective facts. When you're looking at these situations, the reasonable articulable suspicion test is the totality of the circumstances. You look at objective facts as viewed subjectively by the police officer, given the police officer's training and experience. So there's a subjective and an objective component. But
well, just to pick up on Vice Chancellor Noble's question, which facts does the state rely on as constituting the basis for reasonable and articulable suspicion?
Well, I think it's the totality of the circumstances. What's
in that totality?
All right. What's in that totality? I think it's four things that the trial judge enumerated in his ruling on the pretrial suppression motion. He said, one, there was the fact about the tag, although the officer ultimately was mistaken, that this actually was a valid registered vehicle. He had just switched the numbers around when he checked the third time. The second factor was the unsignaled turn. When the vehicle in which Mr. McDonald was riding as a passenger left the convenience store parking lot, it turned onto Irish Hill Road, which is a county road in Kent County, without a signal. There was no turn signal. It turned right. And the officer did not observe a turn signal. So the officer's determination was that that was a violation of Section 4155, subsection B of Title 21 of the Motor Vehicle Code, that there was no turn signal. The third factor that the trial judge relied upon was the officer's response to actual court questioning after the initial direct and cross-examination. The officer said at one point that this particular location, the Canterbury Shore Stop, has been the site of contraband drug transactions at night, and in addition that the store itself has been robbed, I think he said, either several times or numerous times. So there was the indication that there was at least some drug activity in the area, plus some criminal activity had also occurred in the area.
Is it your position that the criminal activity, drug trafficking area information can be added to the mix even after the police officer said that had nothing to do with his thinking on it?
Well, I think it can be added to the mix of the totality of the circumstances. I think the question, and I'm not sure that the inference that's being drawn by Mr. McDonald's entirely warranted by the record. If you look at A17 in the appendix, which is what he cites, there's a question that is asked by defense counsel after the trial judge has also questioned the officer. It starts at the very top, A17. There's also a citation to A21 for this proposition, but those are the same pages. And the questioning by defense counsel there is, but that's not why you stopped the car. No, that's correct. And you didn't witness anything illegal at the car side. No, I didn't. Now, to see the context of that, you need to turn to the page before A16. And there's also a part of the court's examination, I think, is at B8 in the state's appendix. And here is where the officer's talking about this at the top of the page there. I think it's lines 5. This is the trial judge now asking questions. He says, what do you mean in reference to drug activity? And then the officer's response is, the Canterbury Shore stop is a known location where subjects will meet for drug transactions. So being late at night, I think this was a little after midnight, with two subjects sitting in a car and another on foot by the vehicle just arouses suspicion whether or not they're up to something in reference to a robbery or some other type of an illegal transaction, like a drug transaction in the parking lot. And then the trial judge asks the officer again, says, okay, was the pedestrian in contact with a car at all? And the officer's response is, yes, he appeared to have some type of conversation or something with the occupants. He was right by the vehicle.
Mr. Williams, yes. That's the third of the four circumstances that you were enumerating.
That's correct. And the last
make sure we have the fourth. What is the fourth?
The last one that the trial judge enumerated was unprovoked flight. And what he meant by that, I think, is not the vehicle backing out, but the vehicle backing out and leaving the parking lot without taking time to activate the turn signal. That's the basis for the trial judge saying that there was some evidence of unprovoked flight here.
And so, what does the record reflect the officer said when he stopped the car? You know, they always tell you why they stopped you.
I don't think that was testified to at the suppression hearing. I think the only reason he would have articulated probably was either the tag, was it a registered vehicle or not, or the turn signal violation. But I don't know if he said
wouldn't he have simply articulated what he said was on his mind later under oath?
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
Why would you suggest he would articulate anything other than what he testified to under oath as the only thing that was on his mind at the time, which was the turn signal?
Oh, I don't think he would have said anything other than that. Maybe he said something about the tag. I don't know. It's not in the record from the suppression hearing. So.
Well, when he answers the question under oath,
yes,
about what was on his mind and why he stopped the vehicle, why should we speculate that there might have been some other things on his mind?
Oh, I don't think you have to. I think it's a valid, and the state's position is it's a valid stop motor vehicle violation because it is a violation to turn not in a parking lot, but leaving a private property parking lot when you enter onto the highway, an Irish Hill Road, which is the road that the Lucas vehicle turned onto. That's a highway, and this is a violation of 4155B.
But if there's a 300-foot requirement built into that, and there weren't 300 feet there.
I know, and I think it's, you know, sometimes the statutes have to be interpreted with common sense. And
you're saying everyone that pulls out of a Wawa, a Royal Farms, or a 7-Eleven without a turn signal is violating the motor vehicle law?
Yes, if you're turning onto a highway, and a highway is defined in the code as where it's open to the public for vehicular traffic, that you are supposed to use your turn signal, as the Indiana Appeals Court indicated in the Detzik case that the state cited.
I see you're making our law clerks very uneasy.
Well, I apologize for that. In Detzik, it was a similar type argument that the person had left, I think there was some other type of store, or had left a parking area that was private property and had turned onto a roadway, and the officer had followed. I think he had come into a store, and the officer thought he detected alcohol and was not sure if there was a driving under the influence situation or not.
Put aside the turn signal and put aside the registration, as whether they were actual violations, and let's say hypothetically, an officer sees a car go by and thinks the tag is expired and turns on the lights, stops the car, and as he's walking up to talk to the driver about the expired tags, sees the tags and sees that they're not expired. So the officer now is simply going to say, I stopped you because I thought your tags were expired. I made a mistake, have a nice day. But when the doc, when the officer gets to the car, sees contraband, some criminal activity in plain view, is there going to be any problem with pursuing that?
Well, I guess that's pushing it one more step than we have here. I don't know that there is. If you look at Terry versus Ohio, which is kind of where all this starts, it's a 1968 decision by Chief Justice Warren. In that case, there was a plainclothes detective, a Cleveland, Ohio detective, and he's out on a main street in Cleveland, and he notices two individuals, Mr. Terry, and I think the other fellow's name was Chilton, and they're just standing on the street. They're not doing anything. It's 2:30 in the afternoon, and the officer notices that one of the individuals, I'm not sure if it's Terry or Chilton, walks a little way down the street and looks into a store window and appears to be gazing in the store window for a moment, then walks back and confers with the other individual. And then the activity gets repeated by Mr. Terry, that he walks down and looks in there. The officer decides to take up a vantage point a little way away. He's down at another storefront and stands there and watches this activity go on. Now, nothing illegal that he observed, or nothing he observes, is ever illegal. All they're doing is walking back and forth on Euclid Avenue or whatever the street was. But it's suspicious to the officer. He says he's been working this beat for 30-some years, and he thinks that what these individuals are doing is casing this store, that they go back and forth apparently half a dozen times apiece, and he thinks they're looking in the store to case it for a potential robbery. He's also worried or concerned that if they're doing that, that they probably have firearms as well, and that's the basis for him eventually confronting these two individuals and doing a pat-down of Mr. Terry. And in that case, what the officer observed, none of that activity was illegal, the walking around, but it aroused the officer's suspicion sufficiently that the U.S. Supreme Court said that there was reasonable articulable suspicion there to conduct at least an investigatory stop. And if you have that, that's all that's really required. Here, once the officer gets to the car, he does see contraband in plain view. So I think it's just a question of, was there reasonable articulable suspicion to make the motor vehicle stop? The motor vehicle stop does occur on a highway. It occurs out on Irish Hill Road, which I think adjoins Route 13 at some point.
Well, the purpose of my hypothetical was, let's assume the officer was just wrong on whether that's the turn signal law. Just as in my hypothetical, the officer was wrong about the tag being expired. My question is, if you proceed on a mistaken premise in good faith, but it brings you into contact with an individual, and then there's something criminal happening in plain view, is it really relevant that the basis for stopping them, you know, really wasn't accurate, as long as you thought it was at the time you acted? So in our case, either the officer thought the tag was expired, even though it wasn't, or the officer thought there was a turn signal violation, even though maybe there wasn't a turn signal violation. But in either case, as I understand the state's position, it was a reasonable, articulable basis for interacting with these people, and once he interacted with them, he saw contraband.
Yes, I think that's correct. I mean, that's the whole rationale for an investigatory stop, is that the officer is investigating whether there is or is not criminal activity. And that's what Terry's about.
My question, at least I don't see how your answer relates to it, is if you're stopping someone for a turn signal violation, you're not reasonably investigating anything. And if you're stopping somebody for an expired tag, you're not reasonably suspecting anything. Both of those motor vehicle violations have nothing reasonable to suspect. And what happened in this case is drug activity. So if you're talking about a reasonable articulable suspicion of drug activity, then we have to factor out the turn signal and the registration.
I know, but the basis for the stop was the violation of the motor vehicle code, the failure to activate the turn signal.
Is this really nothing but a pretextual case by another name?
No, I don't think so, because I think there may be smaller violations in comparison, but failing to activate the turn signal, I mean, we've had other cases where people have changed lanes in cars that are being followed by police officers, and that's a sufficient legal basis to stop the car.
Are you asking us to reasonably believe that if there had been two little old ladies who late at night went to the shortstop and one of their little old lady church friends walked by and said hi to them while they were in the car, and they backed up and went out of the shortstop parking lot and failed to put on a turn signal, turning right on the road, or for that matter, left, if little old ladies ever go left, that the police officer would have stopped him and arrested him?
Well, I don't know if he would or not, but he certainly could have.
Isn't that really what we're talking about here? You know, we can go through all the niceties and the technicalities, but what we really get down to is this was a drug enforcement officer. He was in an area where he was looking for drug activity. He saw something. Whatever the quality of that sight may have been in terms of a reasonable articulable suspicion of drug activity. How can we possibly conclude that his real reason for stopping this car was either a fictitious tag or failure to give a turn signal? He was investigating a drug case. And shouldn't the focus be on what were the facts to justify that stop based on a reasonable suspicion of drug activity?
Well, you can focus on that in part, but I think still, and the cases have said, if there's a violation of the law, the officer is entitled to stop the vehicle. And that's all he did at that point.
Can I go at the same issue perhaps from a slightly different perspective? I think the Chief Justice raises, you know, a really legitimate concern if we're talking about kind of common sense, which is that he did suspect drug activity. It was a known location for drug activity. It was the middle of the night. There was nobody else there, and there was somebody having some sort of conversation with the occupants of the car out in the parking lot. But that what happened was that the officer, wanting to be safe, if you will, wanted to find some other basis and not just have to rely on it's a drug neighborhood and I saw this activity and that was enough to make me suspicious. So he tried the tag, which he would have relied on when it got to court if it had turned out to be correct, but it turned out not to be correct. And then the turn signal. But that what was motivating the officer to find some clear technical violation was the fact that he suspected drug activity. Isn't that pretty much the only thing that reasonable people can conclude from this record?
Well, I don't know if it's the only thing, but it's certainly a reasonable conclusion.
Okay, because I think then we get to the next step, which is what's wrong with that? In other words, if there's activity that arouses suspicion by a police officer, but he's not sure that it's quite enough or, you know, quite clear enough to support stopping the car. So he says to himself, okay, let's see if I can find something else. And he believes that he has found something else. Does the law indicate that if we could get inside his head and knew that what he was really hoping to do was do a drug enforcement stop, but was looking for something to support pulling the car over, would there be anything wrong with that?
Well, I think under the way the law is now, if there's a motor vehicle violation, he's entitled to do that. The U.S. Supreme Court has said that it doesn't matter what the subjective intent of the officer was. If there was a violation of the law, he's permitted to make the stop.
And to your knowledge, is Delaware law the same with respect to what I would call a pretext stop?
I think so. I don't think this court has firmly decided that issue one way or the other. Jones talked about under the Delaware Constitution not considering post-contact conduct by the defendant. In that case, the difficulty was that the individuals confronted really didn't match up on the probable cause, and then the things he did after that were considered, and this court said no. Unlike the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Hodari D, that we're not going to consider post-contact conduct by an accused.
To follow up, and I know time is limited.
Certainly.
Is it fair to say that in defending this appeal, the state relies on one circumstance, and that's the argued for the alleged traffic violation?
Yes, I think that's okay. It because
is it fair to say that the other circumstances that were developed on the record as a result of the trial judge's questioning of the officer do not form part of the state's case?
No, I think they do because they're basis for the judge's decision.
Well, wait a minute. You're defending this appeal, and therefore you're relying on the circumstance that appeared in the affidavit of the officer. But now, it followed from that you're not relying on anything else. And now you tell me you are relying on other circumstances that did not form part of the officer's mental process, if you believe what the officer said. I mean, what is it? You know, what is it? You seem to be moving around, and I don't know what the target is.
Okay. I think the target is the totality of circumstances. Totality of circumstances includes the four things that
suppose we disagree and were to conclude that your case rises or falls on what was in that affidavit. What is your position?
Well, then I think the affidavit says it's a right turn violation or turn signal violation.
What if it turns out that that's not an accurate statement?
Well, then I guess we lose, but that wasn't the basis the only basis for the trial judge's decision.
Well, let me try to combine the last two questions by Justice Berger and Justice Jacobs, because the predicate for my question is, really, is there anything wrong with what I'm going to ask you in this question? And if there's not, then you don't need the totality of the circumstances. But let's assume the officer testified, I'm in the drug enforcement unit, and I was sitting in the parking lot at this Canterbury store for an hour, and I saw a lot of people come and go and walk around the lot, and I saw a lot of cars exit and never put on their turn signal. But when this car went out of the lot without putting on its turn signal, I thought, this is great luck, because I'm suspicious about these people for drugs, and this will give me an opportunity to talk to them. So that's why I decided to stop them. And I had even better luck when I stopped them for the turn signal violation, because these drugs were in plain view. Now, if that had been the officer's testimony, that he welcomed the opportunity to stop them for not putting on a turn signal because he was suspicious, and he did, and he saw the drugs in plain view, would that be a problem?
Well, the U.S. Supreme Court says no. And then it's a question of whether this court, under state constitutional law, wants to take a different view. The problem with getting into that is you're trying to delve into subjective mindsets.
Even the United States Supreme Court would say that the officer would have to have a reasonable basis for that suspicion.
Oh, certainly. And I mean,
the issue becomes perhaps but for the trial judge's cross-examination of the police officer, there wouldn't have been any articulated reasonable basis for suspecting drug activity. And reasonable people can quarrel even after that cross-examination that there remains any reasonable basis to suspect drug activity. Because it boils down to nothing more than at some point in the past there had been criminal activity in that parking lot, and there are two people in a car and another person walks up and has a conversation with them. There isn't any more than that.
Well, that's correct, and I mean, I think that's analogous to Terry. It's just people walking on the street, but through the eyes of the police officer, that arouses his suspicion.
As far as the deference to the trial judge's findings in this case, given that scenario of cross-examination and a conclusion about a rather hyperbolic phrase, unprovoked flight, and the fact that the trial judge began to rule before he heard argument, should that raise any question in our minds?
Well, it may raise a question, but I think you still have to look at the record, and the record is whatever the testimony was, and the testimony was the direct examination, the cross-examination, and the court's examination, and some further defense cross-examination. That's the record that was before the trial judge.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Please, Court, I did want to bring to the Court's attention that this same trial judge did write a pretextual stop opinion in another case. I can't remember the citation to it, but it's fairly recent. And it involved, I believe.
Is it in your brief? Have you given a copy to the counsel?
It's not, but I just thought it was my duty to bring it to your attention. It came out after this appeal was initiated and after it was briefed, but it involved a turn signal case where there wasn't 300 feet between the two roads, and it was a drug stop. But there's one trial judge, the same trial judge, has written an opinion on that. I don't have it cited here. It wasn't part of my original argument.
Does Heath ring a bell?
Yes. That's all I wanted to bring to the Court's attention.
All right. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.